down the railroad track. It makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. To hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. It's many miles I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Pal to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
That's me. This is Dave Monk, the Prairie Monk, WAFT, Champaign. Happy Christmas to you all. I'm trying to do this by myself today, so you'll have to understand. I think I have to put the microphone a little to the left so you can see me. And I think we're doing okay. So, I thought I would take you back to Australia. I do field trips every so often, and so this would be a little bit like I was taking you on a plane to Sydney. So we're headed for Chicago by Amtrak. We get on a plane at Chicago, and these days you drop off at Los Angeles or San Francisco, but you no longer stop at Hawaii or Fiji to refuel. You can go straight to Sydney, and it's a long flight. It used to be about 18 hours. I think it's been shortened to about 14 hours, but it is a long flight. When you come into Sydney, you circle around for a while. So you look to see the bay where early settlers came. Captain Cook traveled the world, and he found a bay south of Sydney, and it was fairly shallow, and there was a little harbour further north that was more attractive. So early settlers came as convicts. The war in America had resulted in the English not being able to send convicts to the American colonies anymore, so they sent them to Australia, and Governor Phillip was one of the early governors, and early convicts were lucky to be there because they had been in inner suburbs of various cities in England, Liverpool and Manchester. They'd somewhat been peasants that had been moved off land so that gentry could have estates. And so the technology had reduced the number of jobs that people have, and it was not easy to live in the inner suburbs of those cities. So there was theft, and there was a lack of housing and jailing, and if you were lucky, you got sent to the colonies. So the first white settlers in Australia were convicts, and they came together with Australian Aboriginals, who are very communistic in their way. They like to share with people, and they were a little surprised by the settlers, but they shared and probably were responsible for surviving the settlers, because the land in Australia has been very well water-worn and not very fertile. It's not like the plains the Midwest of the United States. I'll have to shut the door. Coming into Sydney, you encounter Botany Bay first. It's where the airport is, so you fly into Mascot and land over Botany Bay. The colonial settlement was on Sydney Harbour. Sydney Harbour, you have to understand, is an estuary. That's where a water-worn terrain has been either the land has dropped or the sea has risen, and perhaps a bit of both. But Sydney Harbour is based on an estuary, so you have these hills that were the hills around the streams of long ago. And so the Aboriginals were very helpful, and with that early settlement, there's a little stream that came into the harbour that was healthy, and the settlers settled there. And there was a coastal plain that extended about 40 miles, so still very infertile. But the Aboriginals were very good at knowing how to collect animals, grow plants, and actually Stone Age people, but very clever Stone Age people. They were adapted to their way of life. But very shortly they began to realize that the settlers were taking over, and that got to be a conflict. So you had a conflictual situation between Aboriginals and the early convicts, and that went on for quite a while. Just a little to the north, if you're flying into Sydney, you'll see it as a broken bay, or a river called the Nepean at one stage, and then the Hawkesbury, and it comes out as a Hawkesbury River into the Pacific. So some settlement was up in that direction, probably about 30 or 40 miles north of Sydney. So you can see this. You can, if you're in the plane and you're looking, you can see the mountain range that is part of the plate tectonics of Australia moving up over one plate, and it's created a mountain that is also very well water-worn, has been under the ocean, and quite infertile, except for little outliers where the disturbance of the tectonics has resulted in some volcanic lava pushing through earthquakes and creating very fertile areas. So that mountain all the way up the east coast of Australia is productive in spots where there is basaltic loam and igneous activity. I grew up near to that sort of situation. And let's bring you into the airport. Sydney is probably about 2 million people, more than that. And it is a major city. The Australia is very sparsely settled, but there are five major cities. Sydney is the largest. It's Melbourne, Adelaide, Brisbane. Adelaide and Brisbane are more, they're not country towns, but they're not as large as Sydney and Melbourne. From a rainfall point of view, the clouds with modest rain coming from the Indian Ocean go right across Australia, across its deserts, because there is no mountain to lift the water up and drop it. And so the rainfall we get from east to west is rainfall that falls on those mountains. We also range from a winter rainfall area to a tropical rainfall area. So where I grew up, we are on the south fringe of tropical rainfall. And about this time of the year, getting into January, we would have the tail end of monsoons, the tail end being we were at the south side of the monsoon. It's summer in Australia, and then there comes rain, and it rains on those mountains. Where I grew up, there was a 2,000-foot mountain. I would wake up in bed on the veranda of the house and look at the McGrath's Hump just a few miles away. With if it was rain period, you would see waterfalls on the mountains, perhaps 10 or 12 different waterfalls, and that water would accumulate in a river called the Bellinger River, after a person of note in England. And that water ran along the front edge of the fault of the plate tectonics, and then all of a sudden take a right angle and run out to the sea. Those sorts of rivers were usually fairly fast flowing, and they took rain up to 80 inches a year quickly. So you had to sometimes have a boat on one side of the creek or river so that you could get across the stream when it flooded and you didn't get home on time. School children had to be let out early so that they would be able to get home before the creek would come up, or the river would come up. The bridge across the river was a low bridge, and it would also flood. So going back to Sydney, you're there in Botany Bay, and I'm going to take you a short trip to Glenfield, which is about 40 miles out of Sydney. When you grow up in the boondocks, you don't have the opportunity to have a high school. You can do high school work with correspondence and bush wireless, or you can go to a boarding school. So I went to an agricultural boarding school, all male. It was one of several schools where the state ran the school, and it was a boarding institution. This was not a greater public school, a private school. It was a public school, and it had about 400 acres of ground for farming. So I grew up there, and I would take you away for the end of the term or semester. We would get a ticket issued by the state, so we would go home for the school vacation, and it's about 6 weeks of vacation over the Christmas period. And so you'd go to a big central railroad station, not too different from the railroad stations that were here. Sydney was a center, and Sydney railroads would be like spoking out from Sydney, and they still do that. But we would get on the North Coast Mail. So schools service different areas, and my particular school was Hulston Agricultural High School. It had been a little farm school in Sydney, but had been superseded by moved out as a result of development. And so Hulston Park is still a suburb of Sydney, but that's where the school was. It was moved out to Glenfield, then in the country. And people who boarded there were expected to contribute to their cause by milking cows, feeding hogs, chickens, doing the horsework, driving tractors, producing the agriculture that would allow that sort of school to survive. Those schools have more recently been converted into co-educational schools, so that women have a part of being able to get high school experience of this style. There were about 200 boarders and about 200 people who'd come in by day train. The little trains came by as passenger trains, but there were also trains that brought coal into Sydney, and there were waterways that allowed water from those mountains that I was talking to run into Sydney and provide water for Sydney. So we're at Sydney Central Railroad Station, and it's quite an experience to be there. If I go back today, I will probably get goosebumps being in that situation. It is just you have a feeling for people moving and trains coming in. I'm mature enough that our trains would be run by steam engines, and the steam engine would shunt the train in and be ready to go. Gradually, people would come in, and conductors would check you out. Some of the cars were corridor cars. They're more up-to-date. But some of the cars would be box cars, where you had doors all the way along opening to the outside world. And the truck conductor, if the train was moving, would be on a step outside and would move from door to door. You had probably about 10 or 12 seats, but often you had more than that because I grew up in wartime and trains were full with troops as well as people going home for something like Christmas holidays. So sometimes the train was loaded not only with passengers but with prisoners of war from Italy and Germany and other countries. We didn't have prisoners of war from Japan at that time, but we did have real scares that the Japanese would invade Australia. They had sat outside the Sydney Harbour and had midget submarines. They were designed to cut through protective grids that were placed in the harbour to stop people from submarines from coming into the harbour. And so these sorts of midget submarines run by about two people could come in and cut through those sorts of protective areas. There were one or two bombs of sort that were fired across Bondi Beach from the Pacific into Sydney Harbour. In my little town, we were prepared. Already there had been troops going off to the Middle East for World War II. Cavalry in those days, soldiers were recruited by cavalry, and I can remember hundreds and hundreds of horses coming by, recruiting local people. And in the background behind that, the road up the mountain was tunneled with explosives to cut that road if Japanese came in. The horses were not always well-mannered. Some of them were rambunctious. They did go off to the Middle East, but in the time of Rommel and others, the technology rapidly moved away from cavalry to tanks and heavy equipment that in the early stages of the war. Japan scare came later with the invasion of Hawaii and U.S. intervention and movement into the World War II scene. They'd already been talking about being in the European theater. So we had most of the houses would have blinds, and the cars had shades on the headlights so that planes that came in could not exactly know where Sydney was or where suburbs were that might be targets for bombing. And you had rationing. There was you didn't get much gasoline. You had to be very careful about that. A lot of the trucks had charcoal producers. They would take trees and burn them in an anaerobic situation, and that would make charcoal. And the charcoal was used to have a charcoal burner on your truck rather than using gas. So an interesting time. There was a voluntary CDC, a Voluntary Defense Corps. So people who didn't go to war or weren't allowed to go to war because they may have been essentially agriculturalists providing food, and people like teachers. My father was a teacher. He was in the voluntary aid divisions that supported in the background. He had 303 rifles ready to do things. And we had visits from people who taught you how to cover up a bomb with a rug or a carpet reduce its effectiveness, or if it was a grenade, it might be the same sort of thing. So all these things were going on. Okay, we're in a different century, and we're on a train going up the North Coast, past Newcastle, past Kempsey, to a little town called Raleigh. And you note that these towns were often named after towns that were English. Australians are basically English, about one-fifth Irish. So the name's Bellinger, and so we'd get off that train and travel by bus 10 miles to Bellinger, which was on the Bellinger River, which was one of these rivers that run along in front of the plate tectonic mountain and then out to sea. These were not the sort of rivers that were very navigable. You could get up probably 20 miles into the river, but then you're getting into shallow water. But these towns were near to the mountains where there were rainforests, and those rainforests provided lumber for the building of ships, coastal ships, that were the main transportation. There weren't good coastal harbors, so you had to have jetties that ran out into the ocean, and ships would park there, but not very well protected. So people would often have to be landed on the jetty with a crane, and people would be put into a basket. So you didn't have a gangplank where poor people walked onto the jetty. You were in sort of rough seas. So if you didn't have a harbor with protection, you were dealing with the elements. Many people came to settle in the areas where I grew up in that manner. And we did have an industry which is mainly dairy and mixed agriculture. You grew potatoes and peas and beans, and you had cattle for dairying, and the dairy cattle provided milk for hogs, and you had corn, and you called it maize. Zia maize is the botanical name for corn. And basically pasture. The pasture would be on alluvial floodplains. If you have a river, it usually doesn't run very straight, unless it's in a sort of fault line when it can run straight. But it brings with it from the mountains some of that volcanic soil, which is rather rich. And that makes the alluvial floodplains rather useful for agriculture. So the dairy herds would sometimes be numerous. The teaching of people about running farms was limited, so you had some farmers who would have 10 cows that would probably make more milk than a farmer who had 50 cows that didn't feed them well. Behind the agricultural area were second-grade hills that had been well leached under the oceans. And that's where you would keep beef cattle and let them roam at will. We're coming to Bellingen. Bellingen is a nice little town. In its day, it had churches which were heavy duty in those days. There was a city council, and there were shops. There was Hammond and Wheatley's, and there was a press, a newspaper, and a police force, a CWA, a Country Women's Association. And we would go, my little town, village, Burg, was 10 miles further past Bellingen, so on Friday night we would come to town. We had grown up with bare feet, so if we came to town with shoes on, we invariably had the shoes off, and there was always a problem because you managed to lose it. A child would lose one of their shoes, and so parents would be looking for the shoes of the children that grew up without shoes. Without shoes was quite sensible because we were in a monsoon area or just at the south edge of it, and if you were running cattle, bare feet with mud was much better than to have boots. You just hoped you didn't have any broken glass or anything like that in the yards, but you did have dogs. I used to work for people who would go on vacation, so I used to handle herds of cattle to give farmers a well-earned vacation. So, you would be dealing with mud in bales. I can remember the day when I had been an agriculturalist at an agricultural high school, so I knew about cleanliness and bacterial involvement in milk and things like that. Well, so I washed out and cleaned the bales as I thought they were supposed to be done. But the cows wouldn't come into the bales. The next door neighbor just looked at me and he says, just put some mud back in the bales, the cows will come in. And they did. But you don't worry about a few bacteria and things like that. Some cows are milked by hand. You have to learn how to take a teat and squeeze with your thumb and forefinger and then gradually move through the second, third fingers to your little finger, and the milk will come out. And the cows are so grateful to be milked, being bred to have a good milk production. Some of it is more creamy than others. So if you have Jerseys and Guernseys, you are likely to have high butterfat content, like 4%. If you have a big cow like a Friesian, it's more for milk production and might only have 2.8% milk fat. Some farmers had milking machines, and the milking machines have a cup that you put onto the teat, and it's a vacuum, so it sucks onto the teat, and then you have four suction pads like that, and then the milk runs into a milk line and falls into a vat. And in the area where I was, you could only deal with butterfat because we were somewhere between about 350 miles from Sydney. There was no way you were going to send milk to Sydney. You had to send butter to Sydney and to England. The butter factories, there were two butter factories locally, and various associate farmers were on those factory boards. They were often cooperatives, or usually cooperatives. And the cream that you provided by cream car. The cream car was usually a truck. It wasn't referred to as a truck. It was a lorry, a cream lorry. And the cream lorry would pick up your cream. Cream was in cans. If you had a dairy, it was usually a little way from the road. You would get a couple of horses, and we had a slide, and the slide would have steel runners on it, so it could be pulled across the soil easily, and a couple of horses, or even just one horse. You'd take your cream out to the road and put it in a little protective box there that you could probably get two or three people to sit in if they were wanting to keep out of the rain. And the cream lorry would come by and pick up your cream. The cream lorry would also pick up your parcels and bring you back products like salt for the cows or wood or other products. So the cream lorry was an essential feature of our community. The milk that I'm talking about going into a vat would have to be fairly clean. If you have equipment with a little bit of spot in it that's not soldered and is not protective, you may get a build-up of a bacterial colony there, and that bacterial colony would go produce a bacterium that would then increase while you're waiting a couple of days for the milk truck to arrive. You would separate the milk, and you had the choice of doing that by hand. You have a centrifuge, and the separator is a professional piece of equipment, and you'd gradually move that handle. You could hear it starting to centrifuge. So you'd get it up to speed. The more professional people would have a small two-stroke engine which would do the separating. So you'd have to get the separator started, and it would be taken over by engine. And that cream would be stored in a cream house that had water in it that would keep the cream cool, because the cream lorry would only come two or three times a week, and you had to keep the cream cool. Some of the cream would be taken to the kitchens, and we would grow up with cream on our breakfast, and it would be thick and interesting. The cream that went to the butter factory was usually fairly runny. You didn't drop the cans of cream. You had to make sure that that horse and that slide would be on a fairly level keel so that you wouldn't destroy the product. The separated milk would go to bins and be allowed to junket. You didn't exactly put junket tablets into it, but there were enough bacteria in the milk to provide actually congeal the milk, and that was essential, because if you feed hogs fresh milk, they get diarrhea very easily. So you kept that milk till it went sour, and then you labeled it out in with buckets into troughs. The troughs were usually logs that had been carved out from the local landscape. You you got your log and made a trough of it, and you would have perhaps 6 or 10 hogs there feeding at once. They were, the milk was subsidized by corn, not much wheat. Wheat was over the mountains and further west. You needed it sort of dry. The wheat on the coast is subject to wheat rust and diseases that are associated with more humidity. So the bacon and the ham that you get from a milk-fed pig and from corn as a subsidy or a supplement is quite different from a totally corn-fed or wheat-fed animal. We had no sheep because sheep are subject to foot rot and liver diseases that are associated with humidity and water and snails that are in the water that carry the liver fluke. So sheep are not a part of the coastal terrain. Okay, so you perhaps wonder why we don't have a sulky to take the cream to the cream truck. It's, you have to lift it up. A slide is much more efficient. You only have to lift your cans about 6 inches, and you've got them loaded. And some of those cans are very heavy. You learn how to roll them rather than to lift them. You're likely to get a hernia if you try to lift a can of cream. There's a lid that stops them from slopping around. And they go onto the cream cart and go to the butter factory, where there are big churns that convert the cream to butter. And that butter is salted fairly heavily to prevent bacterial occupancy. Most of the butter went back to the homeland, England, and which was the preferred market. It took about 6 weeks for it to get there by sailing ship or by steamer. And salt provides an exosmosis. If you have a bacterial cell and you have salt on the outside, the salt will draw the water out of the bacterium and prevent it from proliferating or even existing. So Australians have grown up with a fairly salty flavor as a result of this. You can do the same with sugar. Fruit, for instance, has that same treatment. It's to dry the fruit and have it with a fair amount of sugar. You might dry the fruit with a sulfur base, which also helps to preserve the fruit. It might be apricots, apples, peaches, pears. And they are also another product, and also a part of the coastal agricultural scene. Right near the hog farm, there may be orange trees, and the orange trees grazed up by cattle so that they have a stem that's higher than a cow can reach. Cows like oranges too. They also like a vegetation that is an orange tree. But so if you want to harvest your oranges, you often have to have a ladder and collect oranges from 20 feet off a high tree. If you're not careful, you fall over backwards. So you learn how to harvest oranges from an orange orchard. Some of the products from the hogs and cattle grazing provided a growth of a pasture that I'm checking out the time. I've just been raving on here, but we're getting to our little town of of Sora, and it was never for quite some time until they felt that it was a little bit too remote, and so they took the name of a local citizen, Thora, and it was a name for that era, and my father and my mother got there from Sydney. Father had grown up with churches, was a congregational minister for a while, had decided he wasn't as godly as perhaps his congregation would expect, so went school teaching, and he was assigned to a little school in a copper mining area that had been mined out. So very remote school, one teacher school. My mother was an artist, and she had been a seamstress. Her father had been a tailor on Savile Row in London, England, where he had a reputation. In 1914, he took his family of three children and his wife to Australia because England was exporting people to the colonies, and so he went. They had to battle naval boats from the German Navy, and they took off and were lucky not to be taken over by German U-boats. They went south to South Africa, then across the south winds of Australia. It was a steamship, not a sailing boat. And then they went around the area near to Tasmania and up the east coast to Sydney and settled there. And my father had met my mother at his congregational church. And then he prepared all his furniture and they moved to this little copper mining town. And then moved on at the request of a local citizen who knew that there was a vacant school teacher had retired at Thora, which was my little town. And so they moved up and over that mountain and back down into that little town on the coastal plain. There, my father was a one-teacher school teacher. My mother was a sewing teacher. My father was a carpentry teacher. And he still acted as a locum for Methodist or Presbyterian churches in the area. There was a little church, there was a hall, there was a post office. And if you're coming with me on a field trip, you are going to come from Billingen, 10 miles from the North Coast Mail, rally 10 miles into Billingen, change buses, and then take a bus to Dorrigo. Dorrigo was on that hill, that escarpment. So Thora was at the base of the... So 10 miles to Thora, a gravel road, still an Aboriginal or two around. It's mostly dairying farmers that we've been talking about. My father settled there, was expected to be there for quite some time, put in a small orchard, had cows. We had very friendly cows. We had Jerseys. The next-door neighbor had gone up the range to Dorrigo, where there was a tropical rainforest and the soils were much richer. So some people took off from the coastal plain, which was poor, to the farms in the Dorrigo area. It's been a rainforest area. The technique was to cut into about 30 trees so that when the wind, which was tremendous, came across, they would drop those 30 trees, and then they would drop about a square mile of trees, and they would pick up the coachwood and the beech wood and other woods and take them to the boat building organizations and coach building organizations in Sydney by freight rail on that same rail that we used for the North Coast Mail. Uh, So that farmer had a very good cow that gave birth to a calf. So I had a junior farmer. It's like the future farmers of America here. So I had a junior farmer cow, and she was a very friendly cow and a very intelligent cow. She could nuzzle up under your elbow to have her head patted. Our cows were kind of pets, and we fed them well, so they produced a lot of milk. If you'd gone to the beach for a summer swim and come back a little late, the cows would be standing at the slip rails, and you could see those big eyes just waiting to be milked, and they were kind of castigating you for being late. And milked them twice a day, and I learned how to milk cows. And my father got a hernia and had to go to hospital. And Bellington had a hospital and had two doctors, which we knew and enjoyed. And he had that hernia repaired. While he was away, I was probably about seven. I had to milk the cows. We had four or five cows milking, and just keep them on the long paddock, which was the edge of the road. And we were adjacent to a stock area. The Australia was got its cattle to places like Sydney through stock routes. You used to drive them on public stock routes. Every so often there was a set aside for the overnight housing of cattle, and on those stock routes there was also often a pen for hogs, and hogs would be picked up. They wouldn't be so easy to drove to town. But we would use that for overnight sleeping of the cattle. Sometimes they would sleep on the horse paddock. The horse paddock was there because some of the school children that my father taught would come to school by a horse. So there had to be a place where the horse could be. The cows would find a place under a coral tree or where there was a little less wind, and they would all sleep together. And sometimes when I went to go to wake them up, I would go and sit beside them and say hi to them and stroke their bodies. And then eventually they'd get up and stretch and waddle their way into bales. We had the possibility of putting a bale across behind their head to hold them in, but you never had to really do that because they were there to eat food at the same time, and they were very docile. Sometimes you would like to have a leg rope so they didn't put their hoof into your milk bucket, but they even got good at that. You just would push the leg back, and they'd oblige. And if it was a rainy day, you had to scrape the rain off so it didn't drop into the milk. And so while my father was away at the hospital, I had to milk the cows and separate the milk and feed the chickens. We had lots of chickens. They were food. They also provided eggs. We had a vegetable garden, and you had to be very careful to close the gate because the pet cows were very good at nudging their way into a vegetable garden, and if they got in, they could eat a cabbage at one gulp, and then they would retire to a tree and chew their cud for a long time, so they can regurgitate that cabbage. And so you just had to watch, and they were very aware of what they were doing. So if you saw a cow that was about to get into the vegetable garden, you would say, "Ann?" And she would look up and she would know and she would desist. It was just fun. There were horses around. Some people still had horses and sulkies and would go to town in the horse and sulky. So you'd have an area in town where the horses would line up, just like the same as the Amish would do. And it goes back to when the army would come through in the early 1930s, 38 and whatever, recruiting troops. They would come with army vehicles for the day. And when the war finished, those people came back and they were much more technological than before they went. So the horses disappeared and trucks and tractors took over. We would have visitors from the city. My father's brothers and sisters would come. My mother's sisters and friends would come. We'd have a riotous Christmas with all these people. The Australians don't have pine trees for Christmas trees. They go and to the riverbank and get a casuarina, which is known as a sea oak. And it looks like a pine tree, but it's not, and you would decorate it with candles and in traditional English style. My mother was a Cockney from England, and so she would be oriented to having the thought of snow. You'd use cotton wool to simulate snow. We'd have a large veranda and a breakfast table, and birds would come, and tiny wrens, blue wrens, would bounce around, and my father would flick them a little piece of bread. There were willy wagtails, which were a neat little bird that nested under the veranda awning, but would always fly out and defecate outside the veranda. We had swallows, which were much more dirty. They didn't bother about defecating outside the veranda. They defecated on the veranda. We had little dinkies or toys that were reminded us of the area. My dinky was the color of Billy Wills's bulldozers and the trucks, the Rio trucks that took logs to town, to timber mills. So my three-wheel dinky was painted light green and dark green, just the same as Billy Wills, who was the local gatherer of lumber for the mills. Billy Wills also had a mill. And so you get a little idea of what the area was like. And I think about it now and think about the fact we didn't have electricity laid on. We had water from tanks, no laid on water. You had commodes that you took out with your urine, and that became water for the pea crop. So we had wonderful peas. We had calves that were from the cattle, and we would feed them. And